Hello, and welcome to the Morning Bell podcast, where we interview authors, discuss writing-related topics, and talk about the writing process as a whole. If you want any more information about the Morning Bell and what it is, look up themorningbell.net. If you have any questions or suggestions for topics that you'd like to see discussed, email the co-editor of the Morning Bell, Kezia Lebansky, at the email address keziaa@themorningbell.net. Thank you, and we hope you enjoy listening.
Hello, and welcome to the Morning Bell podcast. My name is Joel Martin, and today we are at the Brunswick Street Bookstore. And guess who's back, ladies and gentlemen? It's my traveling around the world co-host, Luke Manley, otherwise known as the guy who ditched me for two podcasts. Luke.
Well, it just happens, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. How's it going?
Yeah, not too bad. Still getting over jet lag and all, but otherwise, the world is still in order, I believe.
Still turning?
Apparently.
Still on its axis?
Well, not like I've checked with the authorities on that.
But you have crossed the equator.
I did. Twice.
Twice. Wait, yeah, that makes sense. So how's Vietnam,
Luke?
Back
again.
Yeah, I was thinking about that for a moment. So how's Vietnam?
Hot.
Hot.
Yeah, hot and more hot.
More hot. Sounds like my nightmare.
It was interesting. There's a lot of curious history about the place.
Yep.
Like the whole. I mean, it's had an on and off war for the last 200 years, or several on and off wars for the last 200 years. So
that's like a lot, yeah.
A lot of curious history there.
Yep.
But
and then you went zipping off to Russia. And
yep. Where they decided to have their hottest weather for the last few decades.
You're a lucky man.
I am very lucky. And then now it's cold. Now I'm back.
Sounds about right. Now it's getting hot in Melbourne.
It is.
For a bit, anyway. But, yeah. Any writing done when you were gone or just jet lagged
and
tired? Yeah,
I've finished off some stories for my short story collection, and I've gotten partway through some more. So, semi-productive. There was a lot of traveling, so not as productive as it could have been.
Yep. Well, that sounds good. I mean, traveling is a bit messy because you go to a place and think, oh, I've got some great inspiration, I want to write something, and then either you're jet lagged, you got sick, you know.
Or you're just lazy. Or you want to go out and find out something, or, you know.
Oh, you're finding an excuse not to write, yeah. That's right.
Not just excuses, but yeah. Wasn't as productive as it needed to be.
Well, it's good to have you back. We've kicked Lucas out of the chair. He is gone, and you've taken your rightful place. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And we have a guest, as we always do, on the podcast. And today's guest is Les Zygomanis. Now, Les is the chief editor and publications manager for Busy Bird Publishing. He's had stories and articles published in various journals and two screenplays optioned. His screenplay, Punishment, was shortlisted in 2014 John Hind Science Fiction Award. His novel, Just Another Week in Suburbia, was selected for the 2013 Hachette Manuscript Development Program. His novel, Pride, was shortlisted for the 2011 Atlas Award and selected the 2009 Oliver Wood Fellowship Award. And his memoir, Overload, shortlisted for the 2012 Finch Prize. Currently, he blogs about neurosis at www.leszyg.com. Les, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
That is a lot of awards and shortlisting going on.
Thanks. I often think it's not enough. I've been writing for 25 years, so I'm...
They pile up.
More than that by then, yep. Yeah.
Yeah, I wish I'd had a lot more than that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a competitive industry, though, writing.
Definitely is.
Especially now in everyone's got a computer, everyone's got a blog.
Everyone has an opinion.
Yeah.
And not all of them are equal.
No, but I mean, it's such a subjective industry, so...
That's right.
You know, you can have five things and everyone will have a totally different opinion on what's good and what's bad and why they work and why they don't work.
Yeah, that's right. And especially I was thinking about this the other day, and we talked about this a little bit when I was talking about critiquing the critics and that idea. And a comment section is everywhere. You know, it's probably always existed and I just never noticed it, but it's always there. It's on a piece of writing now. When you look at, you know, a website that is showcasing different short stories, they've got comment sections for each short story, and people can say, you know, the best things that they can say, and they can say the very, very worst things as well. about the people.
There's almost always a review of something.
That's right.
Everything.
I mean, comments are a real dangerous thing because you could have 50 comments and 49 of them can be great. You will focus on that one bad comment.
Exactly.
So they're really dangerous. And I mean, I guess comments always existed, but it was usually right to a newspaper. So there was a long...
There's a long process from you, the creator, to your audience.
Now with internet and that, it's such an immediate transaction.
Yep.
And, you know, there's no real limit on how many people can comment. You know, if you used to write to a newspaper or whatever, they could probably fit 5-10 letters. You have a comment section on the blog, it could just go on forever. And it's interactive. You know, people respond to comments and then people respond back. You can actually, and then you have wars on the internet
about different subjects, about different things. And it's really interesting that if you decide to take the option to switch off your comment section, because it'll say like, your comment section has been switched off, or something, people are like, what are you trying to hide? What are you trying to hide, Les? You know,
I'm trying to hide all the spam that I get generally.
Yeah,
all the ads for Viagra and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
I got sick of those.
And all that great, those great comments like, I love your blog. I love what you're doing here.
Please click on this link.
Yeah. It's like, and the first time you ever see, well, the first couple of times you see one of those, you think, oh, great, someone likes my stuff. Hang on, it's spam. No, not again.
I don't look at the address. I just look at the message and feel happy with myself.
Oh, well, now you have anti-spam, isn't that? So you have to flag them.
That's right. It's getting better as well, like the anti-spam stuff.
It's like the virus stuff. I mean, the anti-spammers, they work to a certain date, and then new spam comes out and beats them, and then new anti-spammers come out.
That's right.
Just this never-ending war.
Yep, that's
curious.
Right.
I haven't actually had any spam since I started with WordPress.
Is it a background like anti-spam, though, do you think?
Yeah, it's definitely turned one on. But I remember my old site was through an old build of WordPress that my friend had set up. And I was getting spam every day, every and I turned the comments off, like you're saying.
Now that you mention it.
But I haven't gotten a single one. Oh, no, maybe one. I have gotten one, I think.
You have. Okay, so because I had a website that wasn't through WordPress, I had one built, so just like a .com address, and then that lasted for about 2 years. And every day, you know, the spam would come 10, into 20, my business email
30,
and just be like
40,
yeah, 40. And it was so annoying because I'm very OCD like that. I like to have a clean inbox and everything in folders.
Yeah.
So once I see, and I haven't checked my email in say 4 days because it's not personal email, it's just website email. It just piles up, and you got like 1,000 emails that you need to. And in the case that you might miss a legitimate email, you can't just delete
it
all
and delete. Yeah, no.
So,
I mean, I find the plugins are generally good. I mean, I monitor two WordPress sites, which is my own personal one and the work one.
Yeah.
And the plugins will work for a certain period of time. Nothing will get through, but then somewhere down the track, things will start seeping through, and then you either need to update the plugin if it's available, or you just need a new plugin.
Yeah. Ever since I've changed, like you exactly said, Luke, when I changed to WordPress, when I took the site off and then just changed it back to .com on the WordPress, I haven't got any spam. It's really, really odd. But I guess they have really good systems currently.
Currently, yeah.
Currently.
I noticed with our work on, we started to get just a couple again after a long duration where we didn't have anything.
Yeah.
So they're starting to beat the plugin.
Yep. Got to beef it up. You know, this is a funny thing, actually. This is not spam, but I had a best man speech that I needed to do last week. So
you search through your spam for inspiration, right?
Yeah, that's right. Oh, you could come up with a lot. Probably not what you could say
really
in a best man speech.
I really appreciated all of the things that you have written and said during your life. And
that's right. No, it was interesting to me because I'm a fiction writer. I don't do nonfiction for the most part.
Yep.
And trying to write something about a real-life person that you know without fictionalizing his life, it's kind of difficult, I found.
I find that I need to sort of know pretty much everything about them so I can fashion some story which just dismisses 98% of what I learn.
Mm-hmm.
But I find I can't go ahead until I know everything. But I mean, ultimately, I think everything becomes a story. So it's what's a story you want to portray.
That's right.
It's just finding that angle into it.
Yep. That's right. And once you get it in, then it just flows off naturally.
Starting
and
with the right anecdote.
It's always good to like start with a story or to, you know, it's the usual rule. It's like congratulate everyone and that kind of stuff. Then go into a story and then lead off from that story into what sort of That's what I meant. So that's pretty much what I did. It was my brother, so I had a lot of stories.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But you've got like a 5-minute window, and you just got to fit it all in and make it entertaining and make people laugh.
Oh, well, in the tradition of Spam, you could have just went on forever.
And then everyone would have just left eventually, just petted out the door. But that was good. So that's been what I've been up to. Not a lot of writing, just wedding preparations. But let's move on to the TV, film, theatre discussion. Let's start off with you, Luke. You have been flying, which means...
kind of watching things, but also kind of being half asleep during
them. Yes, exactly. So
some of them I remember.
So take this with a heavy dose of
salt. One of them I'm going to relate to what we were talking about before the podcast,
mm-hmm.
and that's the downward spiral of modern movie quality. And that was the Age of Ultron. I was looking forward to the next Avengers thing because I liked Iron Man. I really liked everything about that character.
Yep.
And he was still a functional and interesting character in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else about the movie was flat. There was nothing new in that movie at all. None of the lines that any of the other characters said were new.
Yep.
None of the events were new. Most of the effects were the same things you'd seen in all the other movies too.
Yep.
I didn't see anything different.
Mm-hmm.
And people are still going to pay tons of money to watch it and buy it and get the collector's edition. And it's quite depressing.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't watch that again, except just the Iron Man quotes and things. That's it.
Yeah, that was interesting because I do enjoy good comic book movies, even though they are quite, damp pond water trash for the most part. But, I do enjoy a good dose of trash once in a while. The thing is, I didn't even go and watch, I don't know, maybe it's just the flood of comic book movies in the last couple of years, but I might be comicked out. That's why I didn't even go and see the film, and I haven't watched it yet. It's out on DVD currently. But, yeah, like you said, it just seemed very,
Because even the Avengers, the first one, I never followed the comic books, so I had no idea what happens in the comic books. Yeah. I probably should, but as a nerd, but...
Yeah.
But, I never knew what happened in the comic books. So the first Avengers was interesting to a point. Again, it was still bringing up cliches that are in all the other build-up ones from the different characters. And then just putting them together, which was kind of, kind of cool.
See, the tough thing I think the directors have to work with is how do you create a satisfying story when you have to satisfy the fans of all these different characters that are all pretty much leads in their own story?
Yeah.
So putting them together, rounding them up, and being like, okay, everyone has a satisfying arc in this film without being generic.
Yeah.
And they're comic book heroes. So, I don't know. I think that's pretty difficult to do, actually.
I think with Ultron also, I mean, I saw it, I just thought it was pretty much a rehash of the first one. So I didn't think there was anything new.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Joss Whedon as a writer. I think he's a great writer. He's very witty. But apparently, I think he was hamstrung a bit by the studio.
Must have been. Yeah.
Don't know. And if you watch it, it feels like the guts of that movie are missing. Mm. So if you ever release the director's cut, there'd probably be about 45 minutes that they could stick back in to flesh things out.
Yeah.
I mean, as you said, it's really difficult to do justice to all these characters and, have everyone, all the fans in that happy and keep them happy.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my problems with it was Ultron looked like a Transformer. And I just find with like a lot of technology and the sounds and all that, they just all sound and look the same.
The same. All the metallic sounds
The gunshots and the jet sounds. All coming out of Lucasfilm, that all those sort of, reverberating engine sounds and all that.
Yeah.
They look good in Star Wars, but now they're just Star Wars.
So no one's really doing anything new. I'm a big critic of CGI.
Yep.
I wish people would go back to models. I know it's a lot more expensive and
I agree.
A lot more complicated, but models, they look awesome when in terms of special effects.
Yeah,
when you beat up on them. They seem to have a dimension about them that CGI doesn't have.
Yeah, that's right, physicality.
Yeah. If you sort of go back to like the old Star Trek movies that Nicholas Meyer directed, if you've seen Star Trek 2 and Star Trek 6, where the Enterprise is getting a battering, it looks awesome because it feels like that ship has physicality and it's losing its structure and all that.
Yeah.
Whereas CGI just looks like really nifty paintings. It looks three-dimensional, but it looks like a flat depiction of three-dimension.
Yep.
One of the interesting criticisms of the new Hobbit movies, especially the last one, was that it's just one giant fight scene.
Oh, I mean, I wasn't a big fan of Lord of the Rings, the movies. I thought they were brilliantly realized. I thought they were brilliantly cast. It looks brilliant. But the 5-10% that he changed, Jackson changed, and not that he changed to condense the story, but just that he changed to have some authorship over the property, it seemed, I thought it really ruined it. And The Hobbit, he just changed about 95% of everything after the first movie. And the second movie, the way that began was shameful. Like, I just sat there. I see movies of a couple of guys regularly, and we're just groaning because where they finished the first movie and began the second movie with Beorn, if you use what the book did, which is Gandalf telling Beorn the story of the adventure and introducing the dwarfs, that's a perfect introduction for a movie to recap what's happened.
Yep. Yeah.
He did something completely different, and he never got back on track.
Yeah.
And then things like the love triangle and all the CGI and the insane battles with the dragon and building giant gold. I mean, you really have to stop me. This podcast will go 3-4 hours just on how much I dislike the second and third movies. Yeah. I thought the first one had some moments of absolute brilliance.
Yeah, I agree completely. Yeah.
But the second and third one, he just left the books behind, and it was like it played out like the screenwriter was a guy who the producer knew the story, told his son told the neighbor, and the neighbor wrote it down and gave it to an 8-year-old kid, and the 8-year-old kid goes, you need to write this story, and this is what happens. And so it just got lost a lot somewhere in translation, just became this absolute mess.
Cool. Try this thing.
A giant golden dwarf statue.
And a lot of it played like a game also.
Yes.
You know, Legolas just defied physics time and time again.
He was mostly CGI for the most part, and in some of the scenes...
I think Orlando Bloom is CGI.
Kudos to him for keeping his looks. Yeah. It looks very little difference. Oh, dear.
And the one thing, I mean, before the third one came out, I was saying to my two friends, like, I was saying, they're going to bring Aragorn in somehow, and we're all going to just groan and then maybe commit harikari before the movie finishes. Fortunately, it was just a reference at the end, but it was still extremely bad.
Yep.
It was horrible.
It was bad,
I mean, the Hobbit movies have basically disappeared, you know, with very little fanfare. So
which is sad in two ways, because I'm sad because they have, and I think the criticisms are valid, but I think also we're going in with a harsh stick because we've seen Lord of the Rings and because we hold it to a standard that cannot be attained after Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
Because even the film, Lord of the Rings had problems. Like, they had big problems that the fans of the books did not like. I would love, and this will never happen, but I would love a director, not Peter Jackson, because I think it needs a fresh... And I really wish that Guillermo del Toro, initially attached to the project, I think he would have done a great job. And I would have liked to see his take on it, because he did say that he was changing things and making it his own instead of the Peter Jackson version of Lord of the Rings. But I would wish another director to take something like The Children of Húrin or a story from The Silmarillion.
The Silmarillion would make a great miniseries.
Yeah. It'd be amazing, like a well-produced miniseries. Like,
what they need to do is not go for the large blockbuster sort of style film. It's actually do the Hobbit for kids. It was a kids' book.
Yeah, they were adultifying it for the most part.
And there was already a cartoon made, a very old cartoon.
Yeah,
it was kind of cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
What they need to do is something the kids can watch. A bit like a Narnia thing, but, you know, with the Hobbit.
Yeah.
Because it was an entertaining tale. It needs to be told the way it was told, which was comical, which was... light.
Yeah.
And it had tones of darkness like near the end, but it was still
light.
It was still a kid book.
And in many ways, I think that was
the That was
issue.
One of the things that destroyed the films, making dark and really angry, and it's a vengeance story, and it's a everybody, you know...
I mean, one of the biggest issues was it went from 2 movies to 3 movies, which is like, all right, well, you have a 350-page book, which is now 9 hours worth of movies.
Yeah.
And you could just feel the padding everywhere.
Mm.
And once they did that, it really just sort of became a money-making exercise, it seemed, and wasn't about storytelling anymore. Because you watch it, and there's a lot of stuff you could cut, and it wouldn't affect the movie at all.
Yeah.
I was actually wishing he wrote it in a way that someone could do a fan edit later and just cut out all his crap.
Yeah.
And you'd have something that was true to the book, but... The second and third part are so divorced from the book. That
there's not much you can do with that. Yeah, you can't really cut that. It was interesting. Again, like you said, the performances were fantastic. He's always cast good people in the roles.
Yep.
Like, I think Thorin, you know, yes, people criticize his performance. I do not. I think the actor that played Richard Armitage was amazing.
Ophelia and Killy, great.
Yeah, like the entire dynamic with the dwarves was good.
Gandalf has always been great.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
and that's one that sort of Bilbo worked out, was, yeah. fortunately, because I mean, it was originally meant to be Sean Connery Gandalf, and he turned it down. And
yeah,
I don't think that would have worked as well.
I don't think so. Yeah.
So
it would have been curious. Yeah. I want to picture that now.
Yeah, it's hard. That is hard. Yeah.
There's only the one dwarf. I forgot which one it was. It's the one with the slingshot. He was horrible.
Oh, yes.
He was the one that says in Rivendell, do they have any chips?
Yes. Yeah.
The one who was hopeless the whole time. It was too much on the comic relief to me.
Yeah. And it felt like they're filling roles, right? Like, you know, one's the angry one.
I think that's the problem with modern storytelling.
Archetypes.
With movies, too, is in the book, of the dwarfs, you know, Thorin, Fili, Kili, and Balin are the only ones that have any real prominence.
Character, yeah. The others are just names, for the most part.
Except for Bomber, is the fat one.
Yeah.
So your name is the fat one. And in the movies, Jackson tried to give them all identity, and I think it would have been better if they were, those other six or seven were just anonymous and just in the background. We didn't really need to know that much about them, but he really tried to do too much with them.
Yeah.
And he didn't really need to.
Yeah, he's making the Magnificent Seven of Dwarves rather than...
I mean, that's probably also partly merchandising, so they can sell their dwarf toys, and everyone can go, I want that dwarf, I want the one with the axe in his head.
Yeah.
So,
of course.
And it's a shame, because you're not really being true to the story, you're being true to other principles, which are profit and merchandising.
And it's all the different Lego sets they can create.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think about the logistics of somebody taking the license, because doesn't the Tolkien estate... retain the licenses.
Yeah.
And I don't think after this, because they were quite unhappy.
Oh, there's a great article with Christopher Tolkien where he just comes out and he slams all six movies. It's a brilliant article. Mm-hmm. He's really disappointed, says what you see is not my father's vision.
Wow.
And all that. Which was sort of, I mean, he doesn't care. You know, the Tolkien estate's never pander to the studios or anything. You know, they've never had that attitude of you must make this. They've always felt that you know, if someone's going to come do it, they're going to have to do it right. And I think Peter Jackson started, you know, well enough about 5.5 movies ago, but somewhere along the lines, I mean, I was reading an article recently that even Viggo Mortensen was complaining.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
During Lord of the Rings, which is amazing.
He said that, you know, he got into the film, and the first film for the most part was his, you know, he loved it so much because it was acting, you know, and he's an artist, you know, in what he does, and you can see that in his movies. He just picks films that he believes in rather than films that make him money.
Yeah.
And you saw that with the first one, and then again the CGI kicks in on number two and number three, and that was something that Ian McKellen, I believe, he broke down during the filming of The Hobbit.
I broke down during the watching.
This is not cinema, yeah. And he was saying, this is not acting, because I'm just on this fake horse behind a green screen and waving around. So, yeah.
And I mean, one other issue with the Hobbit movies, sorry, like I said, I could go on for hours about it. But Jackson never actually just slows down and lets the story take place. I mean, I recall the best example is in the first movie, they're on the mountain and the stone giants are throwing the rocks. And in the book, it's like three, four sentences. Yep. In the movies, is
they actually get affected by
they
it.
Get attacked by the stone giants, and all that. And I thought that would have been a great scene for visually if the dwarves and Bilbo were just climbing the mountain, and in the background, distant in the background, they're just the stone giants throwing their rocks, and you're thinking, what a gorgeous place Middle Earth is, but how dangerous. And that's all you have to do.
You don't have to make them the center of attention.
Yeah, but makes it, you know, danger, and somebody almost dies and slips off, and it
and that's the other issue. Is like, I mean, none of these people are going to die, so
you know,
so it's no use threatening this peril that Bilbo might die halfway through the first movie.
You know, there's another movie going to be.
Oh,
made,
there's going to be another two. They're called The Hobbit. So. You know, not going to clone another Hobbit or anything. Yeah. So there's a lot of needless stuff. Yeah. And I remember, I think it was George Lucas, someone talking about Return of the Jedi. It was one of those making of
movies,
you know, 25 years ago or something. And I was just talking about how sometimes in the original Star Wars movies, they just slow down and let the scenery overwhelm and the story overwhelm the audience. Jackson never did that for Hobbit. It's just constantly in your face, constantly things happen. It's like Matthew Riley adapted it.
The Hobbit by Matthew Riley.
Yeah, and Matthew Riley's good at what he does, but not The Hobbit. That's completely
different. I mean, Matthew Riley, I just recall when I was studying years ago, my teacher explained that Riley had this philosophy that You know, stories usually had a high point and a low point and a high point and a low point. And Riley's philosophy was just take it all low points and just have all high points. And that's like just constant nonstop action. And that's pretty much the way the Hobbit flies, just constant nonstop action.
And you're talking, going back to Age of Ultron, that's a similar vein in comic book movies because you always want to one-up yourself. And that's something that I think that's a key example of the rock giants. Like, it's a one-upping, you know? Yep. You want to get bigger visuals and bigger scenes and bigger fights, and you never want to stop getting bigger. Mm. And because you think if you end with a low note, then it's, you know, you're going to end with a whimper, and that is going to be dissatisfying to your viewers.
Yeah.
And just not going through with your vision. And the thing is, I believe Peter Jackson is a very talented director. I really do. But I just think that he was being a bit too blockbuster. And the funny thing is, he's not a blockbuster director if you look at his previous work.
I think the problem is, I think George Lucas has a similar problem, is just they get so powerful and they're making so much money. Nobody is confronting them and saying this.
Everyone's a fan of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And nobody's sort of coming out and going, this is not the greatest idea. And, you know, if you read the original draft for Star Wars, A New Hope, the original one, it's completely different to what we see on screen. And it's completely outrageous and stupid in a lot of ways. But people have been telling George Lucas that, you know, you need to go back and work on these
Star Killer? No.
Yeah. You know, and there's an orb of power and all this sort of stuff. Yeah. And people were telling George Lucas, well, you know, this isn't a great idea. Go back, work on it some more. And because he was getting challenged, he was getting more out of himself. That's obvious. That stopped somewhere along the line. I think that's also stopped with Peter Jackson. Mm. No one's just sort of said, you know what, Peter, this is like 3 hours of just a computer game. Maybe you should put some story in here.
Or make a computer game.
Add some controls.
And you're good to go.
I mean, he's given himself cameos in the movies too, Peter Jackson. Yeah, yeah. So like, I think once he's doing that, he's just really becoming overly indulgent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, And that's, I think, the problem is when people are a fan of you and nobody's actually honestly telling you, hang on for us. And to a certain extent, Ridley Scott, moving to another director, has exactly the same problem, I think. He's got such a good reputation, but honestly, his recent movies have just been...
Oh, I don't think he's made a good movie since, I don't know, Gladiator or something.
Yeah, I agree. I completely agree. Because it just looks so hard to stomach. And even with really good backdrops of history that are used even in... Kingdom of Heaven, that could have been a fantastic film. And the director's cut gets close to a good film. But again, it's just you wish somebody was in there and saying, nope, you know, cut this and being honest. But we are running way over time with the movie, so we're going to skip through Luke and go back to Les. Any movies, films, TVs?
Like I said, I see movies regularly with two guys, and we have a pretty good track record of seeing horrible things, or things just become horrible once we see them. We haven't worked out. It's chicken and egg sort of thing.
Yep.
I think we've seen about 50 movies and about 3 that we've actually liked. And usually they're all the big blockbuster movies, like Man of Steel, and which is still my worst movie of the millennium.
I'll agree.
You know, and all those sort of things. The last movie I saw was Southpaw. With Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah, how was that?
Which didn't quite work.
Mm-hmm. Anton Farquhar was the director, was he not?
I think he was, and I forgot his name. The guy that wrote Sons of Anarchy was the writer.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Kurt Suder, I think that he wrote it. Yeah, it was visually stunning and all that. Jake Gyllenhaal was great, but the story didn't actually quite work because it... with the boxing movie is a very simple template.
Yep, that's right.
Boxer against the odds has to win.
Yep.
This starts with Jake Gyllenhaal being champion at 44 and zip.
Yeah.
And then he has to win after a tragedy. It's like, well, you know what? Your talent's not in question. You were 44 and zip. You're not like Rocky, who was, you know, had all his losses and was a bum and too old and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, if you look at Stallone in the Rocky movies, you've seen all the Rocky movies.
Yep.
In pretty much every movie bar 5, he sets himself up as the underdog.
Yep.
Because that's what you need to make a great boxing movie. Didn't happen in Southpaw. They try to set him up as the underdog, but I'm just sort of sitting there thinking, you're 44 and zip.
You're pretty much that.
You're pretty unbeatable. So it didn't quite work.
Yeah.
Television, I'm watching Mr. Robot with Christian Slater and Rami Malek. And
so am I, yep.
That's really enjoyable. It's great storytelling. One of the better series I've seen lately.
Yeah.
Got like one episode left.
The narration is very good.
Yeah.
The narration is very good because you're from a character that is, for the most part, I guess, quote-unquote, wimpy. You know, the idea that somebody is kind of a pathetic human being, but at the same time has this talent and has all this stuff.
Oh, he has this sort of underlying nobility, which is very warped in its way.
That's right.
His application of how he applies all that nobility is quite warped also.
Yeah.
But I mean, I really like it. Sort of one little problem I have with it, which is just nitpick, is just Christian Slater. I like Christian Slater, but as soon as he came on the screen, it was like, there's Christian Slater. He's got he has a very strong personality. He does. He has a very distinctive voice, which he modeled on Jack Nicholson. Mm-hmm. So it's often you look at him and you think, yeah, there's Christian Slater.
Yep,
and it sort of takes you out of the moment.
Yeah. Suspension of disbelief sort of goes away. You're no longer looking at a character, you're looking at an actor.
And he does a good job with it, but because he's been in the wilderness for so long, so good on him that he's back.
Yeah, that's right.
He's actually a pretty good actor. So good on him, but yeah, that sort of just rocks me a little bit when I watch it.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Well, I don't have much to talk about when it comes to TV shows apart from Mr. Robot. So let's move straight on to the topic, shall we?
Yeah.
And that is regarding publishing. Yep. Now, Les, you're a production manager for Busy Bird Publishing, among other duties.
Yep.
First, tell us, you know, what do you do? What does that mean? What does that entail?
Well, let's give you a bit of background about Busy Bird. We are a boutique micro-publisher.
Yep.
We only have like 3 full-timers, 1 part-timer, and a number of interns. We have 2 streams of publishing. One are our own books. We produce a couple of those yearly. Like I said, we're very small. We have a couple of anthologies that we try and produce yearly. Sometimes that's gets pushed out simply due to a lack of submissions or lack of quality submissions. Not a lack of submissions. We're always getting stories in.
Yeah.
And then we have another stream of publishing, which is self-publishing. And we help people self-publish. We are a fee-for-service publisher.
Yep.
In that, I mean, people pay for their services that they require to produce their book, whether it's editing, layout, design, whatever the case might be. And Blaze is my boss. She liaises with printers. She knows them all. And then we print the book, and then we make no ownership on it.
Yep.
Now, so the reason I make or emphasize that is there are a lot of people out there who call themselves partnership publishers, and what they'll do is they'll charge authors. They'll tell them their books are great. They'll flatter them, then I'll encourage them to go on exorbitant print runs, you know, which cost thousands and thousands of dollars, and then I'll come away 3,000 books, and I'll sell like 6, and that's it. And these people aren't transparent because they're making out like this is what the publishing industry is like, and it's not like that at all. And you know, we've had a lot of clients in tears and frustrated, and we had one author who used an international partnership publisher who I won't name, but she spent like $30,000 and she didn't get a book out of it. And what they do a lot is they sort of continue upsell stuff to you. Yep. So it's like, you need marketing, so here, you know, pay for this. You need this, so pay for this. And it's just really, I mean, dodgy. It's really saddening. And yeah, it is dodgy, but it's really saddening because a lot of these people, you know, they're not wealthy. So I know if previously, the partnership publisher, they were getting a lot of retirees. So a lot of these retirees are probably just spending their savings.
Pensions.
So they were blowing all their money on their books, and so they were getting...
It was marketed to them, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and with when we self-publish people, you know, Blaze usually encourages people to get very small print runs, just test the waters, see where you're going.
Yep.
We tend to over-service. I mean, if you see, Blaze works extremely hard to keep people happy and make them happy. Because again, we have seen people get ripped off, and it really is. And we're writers ourselves, so it's also something we can empathize with.
Yeah, that's right. With the publishing industry as it is now, you know, we've seen articles and people talking about it and talking about, you know, the rise of Amazon and self-publishing, and even through not just Amazon but other services such as Lulu Smashwords, and all of those. Self-publishing has become a huge deal, and there's been tons of, well, not tons, but there's been a lot of successes through self-publishing, and often those writers either get, you know, offered contracts with contract runs with different books or previous books or upcoming serializations and stuff like that. And so self-publishing is very, very accessible at the moment. And at that time, I guess that becomes interesting because we were talking about it at the start. Everybody, you know, when a certain industry becomes very accessible, you've got people that are just pumping stuff out that probably wouldn't get past the publisher. The question, which is interesting to me, is that, say you're a writer, you don't have a lot of credits in the industry, you're not well known, and you're trying to get published, why should they go through traditional publishing instead of self-publishing?
Okay, it really depends on your philosophy now or your outlook. If you need a validation, I guess, of being published by a traditional publisher, that's why I'd go to a traditional publisher. Now, a traditional publisher will take on all expenses, all costs, all risks. You won't invest a single dollar in it.
That's right.
But you will only get a very small return, about 7 to 10% royalties, maybe a little bit more, which is a couple of dollars a book.
Yep.
If you wanted to self-publish, you obviously incur all the expenses yourself, but you will control all the profits that come from the from that. Now, with traditional publishing, I mean, there's a lot of benefits to it. There is that validation. There is that branding. If you were to get published by, say, a Penguin or, you know, an Allen Unwin, one of these big publishers, I mean, that's a mark of quality. You know, people will look at your book and say, well, if these guys accepted it, it must be good. Now, with self-publishing, there's always a bit of that stigma that if you self-publish, why did you self-publish?
Yeah.
Couldn't you get a deal?
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's decreasing to an extent, but it still is happening. Now, the other issue with traditional publishing is just time. You can submit to a traditional publisher. A lot of them demand exclusive submissions, so you can't submit elsewhere. And you can wait, you know, anywhere from
9 months even.
Yeah, 3 to 6 to 9 months. Yeah. I waited 15 months for a response once, which was a rejection, but it was a really nice rejection, but it's still a rejection. Now, if you have to submit to four publishers and they took 6 months each, you know, that's 24 months. That's 2 years out of your life while you're trying to get your book placed. And a lot of people now, I think, are just sort of saying, well, screw it, I'm just going to do it myself. And the technology is now there that if you self-publish a book as a hard copy, the technology is there to do it relatively cheaply, and your book will look every bit as good as something that's come out of a big publishing house.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, we use the same printers that Penguin and that use. So you can produce a book 20, 30 years ago, books that were self-published look self-published. The paper was very wide and stiff and all that. And now, you know, you couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah.
And it's great. And then you have e-publishing as an option, publishing e-books. And there are authors who make a living just publishing off Amazon.
Yep, that's right.
But, I mean, the warning there is those people are very, very few. If you look at the amount of people who are doing, or, you know, self-publishing and the amount of people who are making a living off it, you know, I don't know what the percentage is going to be, but it's going to be, you know,
pretty low.
Yeah, extremely low.
Yep, that's right. Luke, any comments?
On the self-publishing side, I'm just bringing out my book because I did self-publish it through Lulu, which means I didn't have a self-publishing group that helps with all the formatting and everything.
Well, and Lulu's, but Lulu's Pod, print on demand.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people doing that, which is great, which is because you get the physical book, but you don't have to actually buy a big print run or anything.
Yep, that's right.
And then you can just order, you know, how many ever you want for yourself, so you can carry them around and go do talks. And so it's a really good alternative.
I just found that it does still have that sort of stiffer paper quality to it. Maybe it's just because I haven't flipped through it enough. But
If it's there are different paper stocks.
Yeah.
So it's about picking the right paper. I think the one we usually recommend is called Nordic White.
Yeah. Nordic White. Oh, that sounds good already.
It is that little bit off-white color.
Yep. That's right.
So, and this is the one thing with printers. I mean, as I said, Blaise lies with the printer. She chooses the right printer and recommends the right paper stock depending on what you're looking for. If you're looking for a novel, she recommends something different to what if you're doing a children's book or
anthologies.
So, so she, I mean, the first anthology we did, she chose a more expensive paper because she thought that's expensive, it's got to be good. And it's a very white, stiff paper. Like now, if you hold the books, they're still very stiff. But since then, we've sort of learned, or she's learned, which paper stocks to go for and all that sort of thing. So you can still find, you know, all the requirements to make it look like a commercial publishing book. Again, it's also going to depend who you go to also. Some of the partnership publishers might go for cheaper stock, or usually they print stuff in China, so maybe it's just whatever they're given. We handcraft our packages for whatever people want and what best suits them.
Okay, so say I'm an upcoming author. Well, I could usually say that I'm anyways. and I approach you guys for self-publishing reasons. What kind of costs would I be looking at for, say, a small print run just for friends and family, 10 to 20 copies?
Oh, 10 to 20.
Or do you not go that low?
Yeah, it wouldn't go that low. If prices get cheaper, prices get cheaper depending on how many you order, because the unit prices get cheaper.
Yeah.
But it's an impossible question to answer. Mm-hmm. It's sort of how long is a piece of string? It depends on your word count,
yep.
sort of paper stock you go for, sort of cover you go for, the layout and all that sort of thing. So it can vary. I mean, yep. you're looking, you know, maybe 1,000 to 2,000. That's a real sort of ballpark figure, because mm-hmm. it is going to depend on all those sort of things I said.
Yeah, sure.
You know, 20,000 word book compared to a 80,000 word book is going to vary.
And what sort of services do you offer then? You said like cover, paper.
We do.
Do you do cover art as well?
Yep, we do cover art. We do the editing. We do the layout. The industry standard for mm-hmm. doing layout is in software called InDesign.
Mm-hmm.
All yep. the publishers use that.
Yep.
But we'll do stuff like manuscript assessments, editing, the layout of the book, the cover design, proofreading, and all that sort of stuff. But it's a case of like, we don't force those sort of things on you. It's like, yeah, whatever you're comfortable right. with.
Yep.
But the one thing I would caution is we get so many people who come in and say, it doesn't need to be edited because my wife yep. read it, my husband read it, yeah, my neighbor read it, right. my friend read it and he's a teacher, my dog read it and he's smart, or whatever the case is. And I can't recall a time where we've looked at one of these books and sort of thought, it's been edited. Well, usually you can just sort that's of open right. it. And it's really, the best idea is to get someone completely divorced from the project mm-hmm. who's never seen it before and just can go in with a fresh set of eyes. I mean, the one bad thing, you know, as writers yourself, you know, you can look at something 10, 15, 20 times and you'll think you pick up everything, you print it out and you see something
yeah,
on the first
right.
page and you give it to someone else and they see something. And it's just because once you get to know your materials that well, your mind starts just correcting.
Filling in the blanks.
Yeah, it fills in the blanks, and you know, so you don't start seeing those things. I mean, there's a few tricks that you can try. With myself, I do my writing on one computer, I do my proofing on another computer, just so my mind makes the association. That computer's for writing,
right.
that
yeah.
one is
mental
for reading.
Mental processes.
Yeah. Yeah. You can change the color of the text,
mm-hmm.
you can change the fonts, and again, your mind has to process it differently to when it was written,
mm-hmm.
but really it is best to just get a fresh set of eyes on it.
Yeah. And so moving past the production and the physical
yep.
Phase of that, what about the, you talked a little bit about, you know, the prestige of being published
yep.
by a publisher and how that is sort of fading, because a lot of people are doing, they're doing it now. Even well-known authors are self-publishing their own work. And the idea is, say a first-time author comes to you and says, Les, I want to publish this book. Do you think I should run it through a few publishers first?
We always
recommend
go yeah. through the publishers first.
Yeah.
But it depends on, you know, what your mindset. I mean, I know people who just say, I'm just going to jump that. I'm not going to bother submitting. I want to do it myself.
Mm-hmm.
Also depends how proactive you are. The reality is, as I said, you can try a traditional pub. It could take forever to get accepted if you do get accepted.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is, unfortunately, it's easy writing a book. It's very difficult selling them. Even people getting published by traditional publishers are only selling sometimes a few hundred copies.
Yeah, that's right.
So we always tell people, look, you know, this is only part of the process in writing the book. You really need to get yourself out there. You really need to market yourself. You really need to take every opportunity to publicize yourself. You really need to pursue things like libraries and bookstores and see if they'll have you in for talks. Mm-hmm. And there's no guarantee that's all going to work. I mean, no one knows what the formula is for why a book takes off.
Yeah.
If people did, then, or if publishers did, then, you know, they would have no misses.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's plenty of stories of publishers who have rejected books ad nauseum, like Harry Potter was rejected however
yeah.
many times, and then someone picked it up and it's become a phenomenon.
Yeah.
But then there's also stories of publishers who have paid, you know, 5-6-figure advances
mm-hmm.
for books they believe are going to be surefire hits, and they flop.
Yeah.
No one knows what's going to work, why it works, how it works, when it's going to work.
Mm.
It just, I mean, it's like YouTube videos of cats, you know. You see one come up on your Facebook wall and it's got 5 million views or hits or whatever. And then,
you know, post your own? Oh, hang on, no, I haven't done that
yet. It's just sort of those things like, you know, I mean, every morning I wake up and then whatever, the Today Show or someone advertises, oh, there's this great story if it's come out and it's just gone viral. And
mm-hmm.
no one knows why it's gone viral. It just...
Yeah.
It's wildfire.
Yeah. But, and I ask this to almost every guest, yep. and that is the marketing stage of a writer. gone are the days when a writer can write something and just submit something and to a certain extent be divorced from his audience or her audience, because in many ways we're sitting here talking to an online audience of people that are getting to know us as writers and the guest, as a writer, publisher, whatever. So we're getting closer to our audiences as this time progresses. Do you find that's not confronting, but do you find that that sort of breaks into the actual, that special egg of being a writer?
I mean, I think there's always been a case where you've had to market yourself to some extent, but the competition now is so high that, you know, you need to get yourself noticed. Sadly, the reality is it is going to break into your writing. It is going to break into, you know, a lot of writers are insular. They don't like, you know, big crowds. They're not extroverted generally. Unfortunately, though, you need to force yourself to be like that. As an editor, I have a children's author. She's great. She does that nonstop, and you see her constantly doing that, and she's starting to generate some success. And I think the reality is whether you like it or not, unfortunately, you have to do it to some extent, and it will be uncomfortable for a lot of people, but it's just something you need to learn to do.
Yeah. Luke? Any comments about the life of a writer beyond just the page?
So now is the day when writers should start being programmers, because you can be insular.
Keep a day
job. You can still write, but now you can do it without, you know, going outside.
And I think that's also a big deal of, like, it's good to write full-time, but it's also good to have a steady stream of income.
Yeah.
So you don't feel the pressure also to think that this is going to be a surefire hit. I guess it depends, really. It depends on the person.
I mean, look, there's no reason, you know, somebody can't make it as a writer.
Yeah.
There's no reason somebody can't be the next Stephen King or J.K. Rowling or whatever. But the reality is it's very improbable, extremely improbable.
Mm-hmm. It usually takes a while.
Yeah. And most writers, the bulk of writers, have an actual job, or they do something to complement their writing, which would be like teaching or stuff like that. So unfortunately, you know, writing just doesn't pay for most people, and you do it for the love of it. If you're doing it to write a bestseller, you're probably going to be disappointed. I don't know how many people would have sat down and planned out a bestseller and actually had a bestseller. Maybe Dan Brown was the only one. But it's just, and I don't mean to be negative, because I always say to people, you could be the one.
Yep.
You know, because you need to believe, you know, because you do need to have, you do write for yourself, but you also do need to sort of have that hope that maybe my story will get shared with, you know, the masses.
Mm-hmm.
But it's unlikely, unfortunately.
As an editor, when you look at somebody's work and you know straight off the bat, you know, this doesn't cut it. Do you have that sense of duty where you say, well, maybe you should not do this?
I've never done that. It's more a case of, I'm in my 40s now. I've been writing 25, 30 years. And you're always getting better. You're always learning things.
That's right.
There's things I don't do now, which I probably did 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. I recall one of my old novels. I wrote it in 2007, and I went over it and over and over it, I don't know, 6-7 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I got as much out of it as I could. And then I had this experience where I just started seeing things I'd never seen before, which is thanks to this piece I'd been editing for work. And I went back to that novel and I hacked out 20,000 words that didn't belong there. And but like now I look at that, and that's one of these novels now where I just say I hope that never sees the light of day, because I don't think it's horrible, but I've learned so much since then.
Mm-hmm.
So with people, with, you know, all writers, I just sort of recommend, you know what, it's always a case of just keep doing, and you'll always be learning and you'll always be improving, but you need to develop a thick skin. And, you know, one of the best things to do is to have people who can read your writing and give you constructive criticism.
Honest feedback, yeah.
Not to, and, you know, family doesn't count, because family just say, yeah, it's good.
Yeah, of course.
Or they'll tear you down because they're family. You know, why are you doing this? Go get a real job.
Yeah.
Go,
yep.
You know, go sweep up streets or something, you know. Yeah. So you need input from various people, because you won't see the issues in your own writing. And like with my stuff, when I work on it, I have readers, but I won't give it out to them until I've gotten as much out of it as I can.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need my readers to tell me this is a problem with this character if I already knew that was there.
Yep.
I need them to see the stuff I can no longer see.
Yep.
And like I said, you need the thick skin. It's going to hurt, But unfortunately, that's just the, you know, another reality of writing.
Yeah, and that's exactly what you said. And with friends and family and, like, significant others, like, they are very hard to give things to because often they don't want to hurt you or they want to hurt you, like you said. And that is not reliable feedback. That is feedback you can get when you're published.
Well, you need to find people who you can trust.
That's right.
But who'll be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, there'll always be people that you don't click with for whatever reason. There'll always be people who offer feedback
that you know it's not what you want.
And there are people who I've seen quite often give feedback about how they would have done it, which is really frustrating. They'll cite passages, and you'll see their suggestion. It's great. It actually makes sense. But then you look at what they've cited, and you think, no, that's actually fine as it is, but they've wanted to do it the way they would have done it.
They would write it,
So another thing is if you give feedback, you need to find someone who can get in the wavelength of how you're doing it.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it's no good sort of finding someone that goes, I wouldn't do it like this, I'd write this, I'd put in this backstory and that. That's not helpful to you.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we're coming up on end time, so thank you very much for joining us, Les.
Thanks
it's been
for
a pleasure
me.
To have you on, talk about the publishing industry and the writing industry. Les, where can people find you, Busy Bird, and...
Well, Busy Bird's based in Montmorency. On the web, we are www.busybird.com.au, and my own website is www.leszig.com.
Okay, and that is
L-E-S-Z-I-G.
There you go. Fantastic. Luke?
Oh, after my trip, I got to try and remember my website.
That's right, you've been out of the game for so long.
Yeah. So you can find me at thesoulshardchronicles.com, that's my website, or at thesoulshard on Twitter.
Yep.
Tweets keep coming in. Website hasn't been updated for a little while, but working on that. So
fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, you can find more episodes of The Morning Bell and the upcoming anthology, which is on themorningbell.net. And you can find out more information about the podcast there. Again, you've got the email at the start of the podcast. So if there's any questions or anything you want us to ask, then make sure that you submit it to that email address. Thank you very much for joining us. You can find me on my website, thepenofjoel.com, and on Twitter, at thepenofjoel. I usually tweet about the podcast and pretty much nothing else because I'm not much of a social media person. but stop by the bookshop and pick up some books because Brunswick Street Bookstore is a beautiful place. And it's got tons of stuff that you wouldn't find anywhere else, as I found. So, hope you have a good week, a good 2 weeks, and hope you join us for the next one. Thank you very much. We'll see you then.